I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to Forma here on the Circe Institute Podcast Network. It's been a few weeks since we brought you an episode of Forma, but we are back with a batch of episodes coming up the next several weeks that we are really excited about. I'm David Kern, and I am excited to be joined this week by Alan Noble, the author of a new book called Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Alan is assistant professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University, and he's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Christ and Pop Culture. His writing has appeared in Christianity Today, First Things, The Atlantic, BuzzFeed, and Vox, and a number of other places. And this is a really interesting book. I really loved it. It's about how to engage with people who are distracted. It's about how to share your faith with people who are distracted, but also how to participate in a culture that is distracted and how to perhaps avoid being distracted ourselves. However, before we get over to that interview that I conducted with Mr. Noble, I want to say a quick word from our friends over at New College Franklin. Located in beautiful Franklin, Tennessee, New College is a four-year Christian liberal arts college dedicated to excellent academics and discipling relationships among students and faculty. They seek to enrich and disciple students intellectually, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and to guide them to wisdom and a life of service to God, neighbors, and creation. Intellectual development occurs through conversation at New College in small classroom settings covering the greatest works of literature, philosophy, and theology, and the trivium and quadrivium. So if you are in the market, or if you have a student who is in the market for an alternative to the, shall we say, big box college options that are out there, definitely check out New College. They're good friends of ours. Their president, Greg Wilbur, speaks at our conferences. We have an event coming up there actually in September that we're going to do a partnership between us and New College, and they're just doing a great work. So if you are in that market, head over to newcollegefranklin.org to learn a little bit more. Okay, so Alan Noble and his book, Disruptive Witness. This is from the back of the book. I think it's worth reading here for the show this week. And it says, we are increasingly addicted to habits and devices that distract and buffer us from substantive reflection and deep engagement with the world. We live in what Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls a secular age, an age in which all beliefs are equally viable and real transcendence is less and less plausible. Drawing on Taylor's work, Alan Noble describes how these realities shape our thinking and affect our daily lives. Too often, Christians have acquiesced to these trends, and the result has been a church that struggles to disrupt the ingrained patterns of people's lives. But the gospel of Jesus is inherently disruptive. Like a plow, it breaks up the hardened surface to expose the fertile earth below. In this book, Noble lays out individual, ecclesial, and cultural practices that disrupt our society's deep-rooted assumptions and point beyond them to the transcendent grace and beauty of Jesus. Like I said, this is a book that I really enjoyed reading. It's challenging and encouraging at once. I think great books on culture tend to be that way. They tend to sort of push the right buttons and to be incisive without being threatening, I think is a good way of putting it. And I think that this book accomplishes both those two things. And I think that it offers and contributes to an important conversation, especially for those of us who are teaching and who are looking to cultivate an environment. That's a word that comes up a lot in this interview, an environment of reflection, of contemplation, that avoids being distracted, because we can't cultivate students who are good at contemplation if we're allowing them to be constantly distracted by the environment they're in, or by things that are going to overwhelm the environment that they're in. So we talk about that. We talk a little bit about the idea of vocation, and we talk a little bit about Alan's history and homeschooling, as well as some of his goals for the book and lots of other stuff. It's a pretty wide, far-ranging conversation, so to speak. So I'll get you over there right now. Without further ado, this is my conversation with Alan Noble about his book, Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Well, first of all, thank you for
joining me on the podcast. It's great to have you here and excited to share your book with people. I've been reading it and have really enjoyed it. And I hope lots of people buy it because it's a message I think that a lot of people need to hear. So thanks for joining it. And how are things going with the book promotion? Are you worn out on the book promotion tour?
I am a little worn out. I'm a little, I'm not used to talking about myself and my projects, you know, this much.
You must so just slave away in a dark corner somewhere.
I prefer to. Yeah. So right now I'm trying to work on my second book proposal. Okay. And, that's what I want to be doing. Right. Yeah, yeah. But, because it's, you know, I'm definitely at the saturation point where I feel, especially I'm under obligation. I mean, I feel obligated to promote the book and share links and these sorts of things, which is good. But at the same time, I'm like, gosh, everybody's got to be sick of hearing about this already. But,
you gotta be
that's the job.
Yeah. You gotta be on social media posting links and writing little quippy things and all that kind of stuff to promote the book.
Yeah.
Even though it's a book about being distracted by those sorts of things.
Yeah. somewhat ironically, yes.
Well, so I'm curious about what kind of led to your, shall we say, need to write this book. I assume it was something that you felt was sort of deep inside of you. And to get to that, I want to learn a little bit more about you, I suppose. So where did you grow up? What was your formative years like and your education and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I can actually tie those two things together, I think, kind of nicely, because the roots of this go back to my teenage years back in Southern California, where I lived in the Yellow Valley, and I was homeschooled. My whole life, I like to say I'm 100%er because I was homeschooled with one of my friends went to kindergarten, and I'm like, I'm sorry, but you know,
that doesn't count.
You're not legitimate. That doesn't, you're not. Yeah. And we had goats. So like, I feel like it's an extra badge.
And so you were like extra unsocialized.
I was in 4-H. I'm not going to answer that. I was in 4-H. So in Southern California, which is kind of special. So we had in our homeschool co-op, there's a class led by one of the parents, two moms led a class on Francis Schaeffer's How Should We Then Live?
Yeah.
And that book blew my mind because I had grown up in some denominations, some churches, some environments that had a very low view of culture and cultural works. And so I think I primarily thought in terms of the world and culture out there being this dangerous, negative, bad thing, and we need to separate ourselves from it. So, I mean, I was a part of the, you know, Cabbage Patch Dolls are demonic scares of the early or late 80s, I guess. I couldn't watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because somebody levitated on in an episode. And so these sorts of things. And so here comes Schaeffer and he's like, I'm watching these films and I'm looking at art and I'm listening to the Beatles and I'm commenting on these novels, and there's some value to this. And I'm like, wow. And the fact that he was a thoughtful Christian and that, you know, he was intelligent and that he was engaging these things and that he was not demonizing or demeaning non-Christians. I had a tendency to in a sort of fundamentalist upbringing, not by my parents, but by the culture to see things of the world as, you know, foolish. And so Schaeffer has respect because of his view of common grace. He has respect for the good things that are created by people. So that was really formative for me.
And how old were you when you read that? You said like high school?
14 or 15. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
14, so you were 15. At that age where you're really starting to, you know, you're starting to sort of try to carve out your own freedoms anyway. And so you,
right.
That seems like it. I didn't read that book till I was much older, but I, in some ways, I think I was embedded in cultures that were similar to that. Like,
yeah,
you know, not necessarily, like you said, not by my parents per se, but just by the right. sort of Christian culture at large that I was a part of, looked at things similarly. So I can imagine how that book would have similarly maybe blown my mind. I think was the
yeah, phrase. Yes, I
can,
that's right.
I think I can sort of get how meaningful that could have been for you.
That inspired me to, at a certain point, as I, you know, finished high school a little early, got a proficiency exam. I took that in 1997 and then went to community college and then got a bachelor's and a master's in English in Southern California at Cal State Bakersfield. And at that point, that, I mean, really still influenced by Schaefer, I decided that sort of what I felt my calling was to help the church participate in culture more faithfully. And I wasn't sure exactly what that would look like, but yeah. that was what I was passionate about. So whether I was making music or, you know, teaching or whatever, yeah. I knew I wanted to do something. Hmm.
So, but how did you said it was like a vocational thing. Like you felt like that was your calling. How did that become clear to you?
I don't know
if it, maybe it was more intuitive.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think over time, you know, at one point, I don't know where he says this, but I heard Tim Keller talk about vocation, and he talked about it considering, I think, four things. And even though I hadn't heard, I didn't know Tim Keller was at the time, I think that's kind of what I was doing. Mm. And that was, you know, you think about your gifts, what you're good at. And I had studied English. I knew I was good at interpreting literature and writing about literature. And I also played in a band for a while. So I was good, you know, at interpreting music. And so I cared about those sorts of things. Hmm. And then I thought about, the other thing he says is a need. Where is there a need? Not just like a financial need, but what does your community need? And when I looked out in the evangelical community, I felt like particularly, at, you know, in the early 2000s, but still today, that there was a need for a more biblical and discerning way of participating in culture. Hmm. And then, you know, the other thing is, you know, can you get a job in it? That was the weak point, but I got a job. So it turned out okay.
So you didn't necessarily, you said you hadn't heard of Tim Keller yet, but in retrospect, he's probably naming what you were.
He described in retrospect. I think that was the process as I was getting my master's degree and continuing to study on my own. Those were the things I was passionate about. And those were also things that I felt my community needed help in. Mm. And so that, to me, that was enough to say, okay, well, this is what I need to be doing. The only question is, what exactly is it going to look like?
So is this, you know, you can answer this tactfully if you must, but is this, is the way you're kind of describing and understand, or is that sort of participation in culture, or perhaps a lack thereof, something that you see as a common flaw in the Christian homeschooling community at large? Or, or would you not, maybe not put it that way? A lot of homeschoolers listening, so, but don't, yeah. You know, you can hurt people's feelings.
I have not been a part of that, you know, community for like 20 years. I mean, so I finished in 21 years ago. So
okay.
A lot has changed. Yeah. I think a lot has changed. It's really hard for me to say. I know that, in my experience in the 90s, late 80s, early to mid 90s, I would say that the failings of the homeschool community to faithfully participate in culture simply mirrored the broader evangelical / fundamentalist failures that I was, you know, a part of at that time in various churches. Mm. And that's probably still the case.
So it seems to me that in a lot of ways, your book is about, so you were inspired to find ways to participate properly in culture? And that's something that, so is that, would you say that's part of your calling, is like figuring out how what does it look like for Christians to participate in that culture in a way that is both faithful to the culture and faithful to, well, your faith? Is that, would you say that's true?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I've done that primarily two major ways. So one is my career. So I teach literature and I'm teaching students how to read carefully, how to interpret. And that's one way I'm doing it at a Christian school at Oklahoma Baptist University. And the other thing that I'm doing is online writing and editing. So I helped found Christ in Pop Culture, which is a website that essentially, I would hope, tries to model that faithful participation. Yeah. So that's how that happened. Now, if you want to know how it got from, I got from there to the book, the answer is Schaefer, because a few years ago, I was wondering, asking myself the question, how has the challenge of evangelism changed since Schaefer's time?
Yeah.
Francis Schaefer's approach, you know, as I read a lot of his works and listened to his life story, here's a man who would have people come and seek him out and ask big questions about life, and they would have these sincere conversations. And it struck me that that model of evangelism didn't quite seem as effective or impactful in 2018 as it did in, say, 1970.
Yeah.
And that was my sort of gut reaction. And so then I explored why, and sort of the two major answers I came up with are technology of distraction and the growth of secularism.
So the growth of secularism is an interesting point. So would you say that you're saying that the growth of secularism is something that Schaefer was not having to contend with, or is it a matter of degree?
Yeah, it's a matter of degree. It's definitely a matter of degree. And he absolutely was, he was definitely contending with it, but, I think it does look different today.
So in the book, you talk about Charles Taylor a lot, who seems to be having a moment. There's been, you know, several books on his work recently, and several of them are really, really good. Do you think that you talk about how he defines secularism in your book, but do you think that Schaefer understood secularism in the same way that Taylor did?
No, I mean, I don't think many of us, I don't think most people did. So Taylor's A Secular Age came out in 2007, and it's 800 plus pages. And
so you just finished it?
Yeah. I think I've read it multiple times, which is insane.
Yeah.
Or at least parts of it. I don't know. Yeah.
At a certain point, it's just evidence of a problem, I think. Or maybe you're just not distracted.
When it's that big, like, and you're writing a book, I was afraid I was going to misrepresent them, because it's so many pages. I'm like, man, I got to make sure I've got this down, because there's a lot.
Like, I'm going to write a 180 page book on this book. And then you realize, shoot, I chose to write a 180 page book on an 800 page book that I now have to read three times. So I don't.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think
strategic mistake.
Probably in retrospect, that's all right. Too late now. In retrospect, I mean, in the 1960s, maybe early 70s, there was still the secularization hypothesis. You know, the idea that by the 90s or certainly by the 2000s, religiosity would be, for the most part, Western countries, industrial countries, would be sort of a thing of the past. And that turned out to not be the case, particularly in America. So that would have been probably the understanding of secularism that Schaefer, I'm just speculating here, but that's probably the understanding of secularism that he would have been familiar with, the one that sociologists would have been talking about at the time.
Say more. So you say that more about that So you would, he would have thought, can you just restate that again?
Sure. Yeah. So
I'm thinking now, so I need you to talk while I think.
Understandable. So in the 60s and 70s, most sociologists, people like Peter Berger, sociologist who recently passed away, and a believer, they believed that there was a trajectory in particularly Western industrialized countries towards atheism, non-belief, that with the growth of technology and economies, there was less and less of a felt need for a religious faith. Mm-hmm. And so people would just drift away. And, there were speculations that, by the 90s or the early 2000s or so, really for the most part, a country like America would be atheist, that people of faith would be in the severely in the margins. And that turned out to be glaringly wrong.
So as opposed to Taylor's idea that faith in God is just like one of many options.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Which you talk about in what is that chapter 2 in the book? You get into kind of defining some of Taylor's ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he talks about secularism not so much as atheism, and his argument is that the older understanding of secularism was what he called the subtraction myth. And the idea is that sociologists thought that humans at their core weren't religious, and then older humans added all this superstition on top of things. And as we are progressing and becoming more and more enlightened, we subtract all this baggage of our past, including religion. And Charles Taylor says that's nonsense. The subtraction myth is not true. So really, at our core, we're religious in some sense of desiring a fullness.
Yeah.
And so his version of it is very, very different.
Well, okay, I want to come back to this, but I want to shift gears to the evolution of your ideas on this book, because you begin the book, before you get to the Taylor stuff, you begin talking about the age of distraction that we live in. And you talked about how, as you were thinking about the challenges of contemporary evangelism, that the sort of distractedness of our age is, or at least of the people who participate in the age, is a challenge, because how do you get people's attention? How did that become something that became, and I realize I'm oversimplifying it in the way I just said it, but how did that become something that, like, how did you settle on that as an idea? Like, how did that become something that you became aware of so intimately and profoundly that you felt like it was time to write a book on it? Was it because you were feeling that in your own life and you were noticing it, or was there actual instances of you were trying to share the gospel and like you couldn't reach people because of that?
Yeah, I don't know that it was inspired by any particular experiences with bearing witness to my faith. But I would say that at the time, what really the seed of this was a blog post for Christ in Pop Culture, and in that post, I was thinking back to Schaefer's tendency and really the very popular tendency to think in terms of worldviews, and worldview apologetics, and how neatly and tightly and sort of propositionally worldview thinking tends to be. And then I was reflecting on, my students and people I know and even my own life. And it felt to me, it struck me, I can imagine this situation, which I talk about in the book, where you sit down to talk to someone about your faith and, you explain your essentially Christian worldview, and maybe you tease out some of their, what you want to call, worldview. But the problem is that it is so easy to tune out and to be numb to things to anxiety, to hard questions in 2018.
Yeah, to like dissonance.
Yeah, I just don't think that cognitive dissonance is nearly as hard to deal with
because you can just ignore it.
You can. Whereas when Schaefer was talking with people who were coming to him who were atheists or Buddhists or whatever, and he was challenging the worldviews, I think they had more contemplative space because it was harder to fill every second of their day with, you know, high quality, high definition, high speed internet, you know, videos, podcasts, music, television, games,
Twitter,
whatever. Twitter. Yeah. Social media. I mean,
iPhone games.
Exactly. I mean, apps that are designed, you know, that have colors and sounds that are designed to be addictive, to keep to draw your attention away from whatever it is that you're doing. Well, in that kind of environment, if you want to not feel anxious about something, it's not that hard. And I know this because I feel this myself. Like when I have anxiety, I'm like, it is actually easier for me to open my phone than it is to pray about it. Now, sometimes that anxiety is irrational, and I really don't need to sit around thinking about it because, the mind is fallen too, and the body. But there's a different kind of, you know, anxiety, that cognitive dissonance when we're living a life that is incoherent, that is at odds with what we claim to believe. That we got to deal with that cognitive dissonance, and I just think in 2018 it's just so easy not to. So when I imagine people having those serious worldview conversations, I just thought, you know what? That person can just walk away and open his phone and none of it matters.
I noted this in a Twitter thread. I think I tagged you in it when I was reading a couple of days ago, but I was really thinking about this from the perspective of teaching. And, you know, our listeners are teaching in some form, way, shape, or form or another. They might be leading a school or teaching a fourth grader or whatever at home. But like one of the vocations of a teacher is like to help students have tools to identify and resolve those dissonances within them. And especially as they get older, you know, those dissonances become more profoundly felt. And so we try to provide like true, good, and beautiful things that bear witness to, you know, even just order, for example. And then, you know, in experiencing those and participating in conversations about them and things like that, those dissonances can be brought front and center, and you deal with them in a way. Like that's part of the project of education. And I'm oversimplifying. But one of the things that we're up against, and I'm sure you see this with your students all the time, just like with college students, just like a lot of people do with even like 10-year-olds now, right? Is that, you know, so what does it mean for us as educators and parents if our students have been conditioned to ignore the dissonances within them? Like, what does that mean about what our current challenge is as educators, and how do you approach that challenge?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because I think what will happen is that the students and then likely the teachers are going to think about their tasks, their assignments, as instruments, right? And so, you know, when you're studying Plato or Socrates or something, you're not studying it because there's some wisdom to be had there, which you can get at by wrestling with it. Instead, you're doing it because you need to, let's say, pass a class, that this is a thing that we do in this style of education. So we've got to get it done. Right. And I've seen that with homeschoolers and, you know, in my own upbringing. And I see that in college students as well. This tendency to think about things in purely utilitarian or instrumentalizing terms.
Right.
And I think technology really helps us do that, because in order to not think about education as just purely this tool, you have to let it, you have to risk something. You have to risk changing your life. Having it affect you, having it change your imagination, change your desires, change your heart, change your understanding of history and people and God. And that requires space for reflection. So a lot of what I talk about in the book, and, you know, I say that the gospel is cognitively taxing. And I think a lot of that could be, a lot of that overlaps with education as well. I mean, it's not just our faith that's cognitively taxing. Most of the really wonderful things in life require some contemplation, some mental space. And if we are training our minds to constantly be clicking on something or listening to something, then we're missing out. So that is a unique challenge, I think, for our time.
Yeah. And I think you talk about how we kind of unreflexively, is that the word you use? Unreflexively sort of respond to the stimuli of the media, the things that we're distracted by, which makes it easy to just sort of adopt. Well, you talk about causes, for example.
Yeah.
It's like easy for us to just adopt a cause because it reveals to the world something about us that we want to be known for or whatever, but we do it unreflexively. Like we can start doing something without having to spend any time deciding whether or not we want to do it or whether we should do it.
Right.
But we don't have to spend money. We can spend money before we even have to think about it.
Right.
Which I think is like, you know, if there's a metaphor for the way we do things, the way our brains work in this age, it might be that, a metaphor, one of them, right? So do you find then that with your students that you teach college students, right? No high school students?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct. So, some are seniors in high school.
So old, they're older though. And so they're at that point in their lives where they're beginning to hopefully consider like their own vocation. I almost said vacation and... probably mostly that.
Yeah, it's actually much more accurate.
But do you think that applies to thinking about vocation too? That was a question I had when I was reading. Because if we can unreflexively sort of just adopt causes, do you think that we spend less time also reflecting on vocation? And so we just sort of take up things that we're going to do sort of unreflexively as well?
Absolutely.
Do you see that in your students?
Absolutely. I see this with the choice to go to college. So, I mean, I'm a big advocate for going to universities. I don't think everybody needs to go to a university, but I think that especially a good Christian liberal arts university has a lot, can do a lot of formation, spiritual, holistic formation that is really good for our students. However, I think that for the most of our students, and I would say this is true at every school, most students, I talk to my freshmen about getting swept up in a stream. I say that, you know, when they're a senior, they took an SAT or an ACT test, and they didn't really probably think too much about whether or not they wanted to go to college, really. And then it was application time, and then it was college visiting time, and then it was enrollment time, and then it was showing up and moving in. And then, you know, one day they just wake up and it feels like a blur, and now they're sitting in freshman comp 101 or whatever, right? And they haven't really spent time thinking, what is the purpose of university, and what is the purpose of vocation? What is the purpose of really my life? And I think things are so programmatized there that we have such a life really does feel like a flow. There's so much going on. I feel like for most modern people, we can just get out of bed and there's stuff that we need to be doing. And there's like a routine and there's like a trajectory for your life and you just get on it. And then, you know, the scary thing is that one day you wake up and you ask yourself, like, why am I doing any of this? What is the point?
It seems like it's one of the sort of tragic results of valuing, I don't know, individual choice or having an unlimited number of choices. Like our culture, what is our culture value more than the ability to decide whatever you want, right? And so if you're going to be able to decide whatever you want, there has to be an unlimited number of choices for everything, you know, from what you're going to do with your life to, you know, whatever else is the flavor of the moment that we're all debating in culture right now. Do you think that teachers and parents should be presenting to our children the idea that this whole unlimited choices thing is bogus and we should actually be saying you don't have unlimited choices. And like, if so, I mean, you don't want to discourage your children from following their dreams, I suppose, right?
Sometimes.
Well, yeah. Well, right. So yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really unpopular thing. I don't want to tell my kids to follow their dreams without exception, you know, without qualification. Right.
Right.
Like,
right.
I mean, I only want them to follow their dreams if their dreams are rightly ordered and glorifying to God and loving to their neighbor. And,
do you find that idea is sort of never been put in front of the students that you teach?
Yeah, I don't think, most college students have heard that. I don't think most college students, Christian or otherwise, at all think about the idea that their vocation should at least in part be determined, for example, by the needs of their community. So it almost always is thought of in terms of what is going to be personally fulfilling and interesting to me, or what is going to make me money.
Yeah.
And that's incomplete.
Well, and that's where the term vocation comes in, right?
Right.
Like one of the things we talk about around here is our business sort of statement. Like in our business, we're not allowed to talk about like vision and mission because vision and mission have this sort of the context is this is my vision, this is my mission, this is what I'm here, this is what I'm choosing to do. Whereas vocation is this is what I'm called to do. This is how I, this is the kind, this is what I'm called to do to participate in this community.
Yeah.
So are there, if we're thinking in terms of vocation and participation in a community, how do you, this is, I guess, perhaps not directly related to your book, huh?
That's fine.
How do you think that that parents and teachers should help students pursue a vocation or hear a vocation, like, or hear what their vocation is. Like how do you, it seems like when you're talking about your own vocation in some ways, it's hard enough, right? To try to hear that, and then to follow it and try to figure out what's actual vocation and what's not. And what am I actually called to do? And what do I think maybe I'm called to do? And what do I want to do? And how does that jive with what I'm called to do? And all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But so how do you cultivate, well, let me put it this way, I suppose. How do you cultivate an environment in a school or a home or even in the mind of a child where being alert to a vocation is possible?
So I think to answer that, part of my understanding of vocation, I don't think of vocation as necessarily as an absolute. So, and maybe I should, but so for example, in my experience, it wasn't like there was like God spoke to me or something,
Or like there's one specific woman in the world that's just for you. Like you're
right. Exactly.
It's not that concept. That's not like
the exact same. So sometimes my students, they do want to think in terms of calling, but I think sometimes they're like waiting for this like divine message to drop from the sky.
Yeah, they want to be woken up in the night by a voice.
And what I encourage them to do is to think in terms of to be reflective about several things. One is their abilities. They need to be able to take honest inventory. What am I actually good at? What can I be? And this is, again, what I'm getting from Tim Keller. What am I actually good at? Where are my skills located? And then two, what do I enjoy doing? That's one piece, but it's only one piece. And then what does my community need? And that's the one that is rarely, almost never considered, I think, for most modern people in general. We don't ask, except for Christians in terms of ministry. Like in terms of ministry, the students I work with are very good about thinking, you know, I really have a heart for people who are being sexually trafficked or for this people group that I want to go and be a missionary to. But when it comes to like outside of ministry, it's very hard for us to think in terms of, well, you know what, my community needs a reduction in crime. Like there's, or, you know, we need a better city planning, right? That's kind of crazy, but those are real felt needs. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth thing is, what can you actually get a job in, right? Because if there's a need, but there's no one to pay, then you need to be strategic about it. And so when you think about it from those four, I think creating an environment where you're talking about the needs in your community regularly as obligations that your household or your school needs to be aware of, that helps create the environment where vocation is not just about what you enjoy doing. And then also being realistic about what the market will support, right? Yeah. Are there actual jobs in there? So, yeah.
Do you think that, well, so this is related to your book, especially the first chapter about distraction. Do you think that then we live in a culture that, like, the environment that the technology that we've made so much a part of our lives is sort of inherently distracting from being aware of calling, like, because you're so distracted that you're not listening for it?
Yeah. And here's why, because I think, the overwhelming information that we have and our easy access to it inclines us to focus on one of those four pillars. And that's the pillar of interest. So right. If I find myself really interested in some obscure thing, you know, I really like the films of Akira Kurosawa, the great Japanese film director. So maybe, I could imagine myself as a teenager getting completely engrossed in his films and thinking, I need to be a film professor who only teaches this, right? And this is going to be
the world's foremost scholar of Kurosawa.
And the thing is, the internet allows me to be surrounded by a community of people who think exactly like that, where this wasn't true when I was growing up, right? So like in the early 90s, you know, if I was into something really niche, there wasn't, I mean, if one of my neighbors or buddies wasn't into it, I had no community. I couldn't. And so so today what can happen is a student can be really into one really niche thing and feel and get watch hundreds of hours of YouTube videos, read tons of articles about it, get completely engrossed in it and feel like, man, that's the thing that's going to make me fulfilled. Right. And that's one of the other things that I think families and schools have to do is that they have to teach students that, your job is not the thing that justifies you. Christ justifies you. And if you go about looking for a career, believing that that is the thing that will justify your existence on earth, then you will always be disappointed. Hmm.
So I assume this is the number one question you get. Well, I don't even need you to answer it, really. People should read the book. But is the number one question that you get, is this a book that is anti-technology? Is that like the number one question that people have been asking you?
Yeah, I mean, it comes up fairly often. I think I could be more anti-technology. I am open, you know, so Andy Crouch is, you know, more anti-technology. He has a great book, the TechWise Family. And there's some families need to think seriously about the effects of technology, especially on their kids, especially their teens. There's some serious concerns. I was able to kind of skirt the issue a bit because my focus is not primarily on how it's affecting us, like the individual reader, but how it affects the reader's conversation with other people. And unless we're ready to like ban cell phones, then the conversation is sort of moot, right? So like, okay. You should really restrict your technology use, but your neighbor's probably not going to. So how do you talk to him about the gospel? And that's still the challenge.
Yeah. You know, I love television and movies, and I'm not as into technology as some people, but like I wasn't the first person in line for the iPhone, but you know, I love my smartphone. But I was thinking, yeah. I was listening to a podcast and Chuck Klosterman was the guest. Yeah. You're a basketball fan. Do you ever listen to the Bill Simmons podcast?
I do not. I have, okay. I mean, I used to listen to it, but yeah, I haven't played it.
Okay. So he was talking to Chuck Klosterman, Bill Simmons was. And so they're talking about technology for some reason or TV. And Chuck Klosterman was like, you know, like in the 70s, everyone was worried about what TV was going to do to everybody. And it turns out they were right. Everything they worried about technology and TV in particular came true. So what do we do about it? So I was thinking about that. And it makes me wonder, like, you know, like we think about our kids. I was also listening to an interview with Dax Shepard, the actor. And he was like, before I had kids, or when my kids were really young, I had all these ideas about, you know, all these rules I was going to keep for my kids. They were only going to watch so much screen time and all that kind of stuff. And he's like, and you know, I still have those rules, but I just break them all the time. Yeah. And so how many kids do you have?
Three.
Okay. So how old are they?
2, 6, and 8.
Oh, okay. So I've got a 2, 5, and 6 actually.
Four.
But do you find that you, as you kind of been writing and thinking about these things, that you've been more concerned about the amount of time your kids at that age spend in watching Netflix shows or whatever, or not really an issue for you anyway?
Yeah, we were concerned right from the start. We were like, Dax, you know, we were like, yeah. As soon as we had our firstborn, we were, we tried to do, I think, like no screen time until she was 2. That didn't work. She would watch something before she was 2, but we generally try to keep it to like a half an hour a day of either certain kinds of TV shows or video games. And I think a lot, I'm very concerned with like the quality of the TV shows. I mean, there's a lot of garbage out there and a lot of frenetic garbage that I think is really bad for their attention spans. And so I prefer shows that have some sort of plot line and are imaginative and
yeah. Well, so that's why the reason I asked that is because, you know, the idea of like cultivating an environment that is more contemplative because our kids are bombarded just as we are.
Yeah.
But they're being brought up even more so than we were in a culture of distraction.
Yeah.
So when they're young, have you thought of strategies for the people who have young children, like, you know, like your children, like my children, for cultivating an environment that even for young children can be contemplative? Like how do you start that early?
I think it's easiest when they're young because you can just restrict their screen time to I would say, you know, something under an hour. Mm-hmm. And then they are going to have to entertain themselves and kids will naturally do that. So the biggest thing is just putting up with hearing them whine about being bored. And so we do that almost daily, it feels like. And you just tell them to go find something because they're spoiled and they have a bunch of amazing things in the world. There's an amazing place that got created. So suck it up and go find something interesting to do. And they do. And it's wonderful.
Weird.
And so, yeah. And that's what I did. And that's what we've all done for thousands of years. It's the teenagers that I don't know. And not having a teenager yet myself, I don't know. Because I'm much more scared about the peer pressure teenagers have with technology today. And I also recognize that, man, when my daughter is a teenager, if she's driving, for example, I really want her to have a smartphone. I would like her to have an iPhone so that I could actually know where she's at just by looking at, you know, her on the, you know, find my location or whatever app. So that exchange of, you know, of the benefits and some very steep costs.
Yeah. You know,
that's scary.
So I've been thinking about it in sort of in these terms, because it feels like on the one hand, there's there's sort of like the specific things we don't want them to get into. Like, yeah, I want to protect my kids from, I don't know, running across things online that they shouldn't see purposefully or accidentally, right? As they get older. I want to protect them from people who are, you know, up to things online that, that they're nefarious. And I want them to make good choices about the kind of media they consume and how much time they spend on it and things like that. And probably they should make, I would hope they would make better choices than I would on that. But there's also something like it goes beyond sort of like the specific things I don't want them to do or that I do want them to do. And if there's something like you talk in the book about environment, we've used the word several times, but like, it seems like there's gotta be something inherent to the environments that we're cultivating that goes beyond like specific rules or a checklist of things that you can look at and that you can't look at and that you can watch and you can't watch. Like something, it's like the idea, we talk about this with education around here a lot, like Christian education an education that is Christian is not just about the checklist of things you teach or don't teach. It's about the way you teach. Like it's about it goes deeper into what pedagogy means. And there's got to be sort of crucial realities and truths within the environment and the modes of teaching that by which you're presenting information and lessons to your students and things like that. And the same thing seems true in our homes and in our schools within the context of this discussion. Like, so I'm wrestling with when my kids are young, before they're being faced with temptations and choices and things like that. How do I, besides just a lot of prayer, how do I cultivate the right kind of environment so that they can, so that I don't have to teach them to be afraid of the culture? You know, you were mentioning the environment that you grew up in.
Yeah.
I want them to be able to participate, and I want them to be able to do so wisely and judiciously. And I want them to not have to be afraid of it. But in order for that to happen, you know, I don't want to be able to just give them, I know I'm going to have to give them some rules, right? And some list of do's and don'ts, but I want them to be able to go beyond that because they've been raised in an environment and in a context where they've practiced participation in the right way. And that's the thing that I think in some ways gives me anxiety as a parent and as a teacher, whether I'm responsible, it's my kids that I'm responsible for, or it's someone else's kids in the classroom. You know, I want to have I want to have a classroom that cultivates that as well. Mm-hmm. So after all that rambling, now my question is, help.
I would say, I think when we traditionally think in terms of culture and participating in it, we tend to think in terms of content, right? So, media, right? Media consumption. Right. I think that doesn't worry me so much. I think if you, stock your house with books that are good quality, that if you show them good movies and you talk to them about them, if you expose them to good music and you talk about it and you do it in an age appropriate manner, I think they're going to be okay. What I think is more insidious, it's sneaky and dangerous is things like social media. So that's what really worries me is these kids who grow up and they're maybe really good about discerning content, but then when they're old enough and they they engage in social media, which happens to be at that same time when they are trying to figure out who they are, and now they have this platform that tells them basically, you need to project yourself to the world. This is how adults do things. And that to me is the more worrying thing. And I would say that the way to address that is to help your kids, first of all, know that their identity is hidden in Christ, that they are loved. And just emphasizing and trying to encourage them to understand that their life is not about creating an identity, because that's what social media tries to convince us of. And so I guess acts of service, things that are pointing outside of us, those are the things that are going to probably help us move away from thinking in terms of identity. But it's a huge, that's the swimming upstream that worries me, because that idea that our lives are about creating and expressing an identity is the overwhelming philosophy of our time, and social media feeds it.
Yeah. Do you think social media is the one of the reasons why it's such a huge part of our lives right now? Or do you think it was already such a huge part of our lives and Facebook and social media, Facebook, Twitter, all that became popular because of that? Like, which is this a chicken and egg situation?
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely popular before this.
Maybe not quite so. Maybe the average person couldn't express their participation in that quite so freely.
Sure. I mean, so when I think about myself growing up as a teenager before, and there was no social media, I certainly was obsessed with my identity and trying to think, okay, what kind of a person am I going to be? How am I going to dress? How am I going to, how am I going to make myself unique and important and valuable? I think that's just kind of it's a very common experience in the modern world. Yeah. And social media absolutely, profits off of that and formalizes it, right? So you can say, and that's what's so terrifying is like you can just all those desires I had and those obsessions I had. Well, now you can fill out a form that says, "Well, these are my interests."
Yeah.
And here's the best photo of me. Yeah, absolutely. In just this blatant way, I tell my students that the social media looks a lot like celebrity magazines of, the 1940s or 50s, right? Yeah. This is the write-up that Cary Grant would have. You have a bio or something. It's very bizarre, but to us, it's normal.
Yeah, it's like the half-page columns in like Rolling Stone or something where they're interviewing George Clooney and you learn like a few facts about them, or like Julia Roberts in People magazine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Except we're all movie stars now and we're all competing to have our existence, justified.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that because I remember you mentioned the insidious nature of social media in some ways. And I was thinking about how when I was, I don't know, so Facebook came about when right as I was kind of going into college, it really started to get big. I think I'm 31. So I think it would have been 2004, somewhere in that range when it really kicked off. And you had to have the .edu email and all that kind of stuff. And I remember filling out a profile. And I had a MySpace profile before that, of course, or whatever was the flavor of the moment at the time. But I remember filling out the Facebook profile and you chose, wasn't it Facebook where originally like you choose, these are the books that I like, these are the movies that I like, the music. And so when you'd go to someone's profile, you'd see the list of all those things. So a lot of people probably were not on Facebook back when that was the way it was. But I remember thinking one day, looking at my profile and being like, yeah, I probably shouldn't claim like Dostoevsky as like one of my favorite books yet in my life. Like I said that it was, but I think I was just kind of wanting it to be. And I was just going through and looking at all the movies and music. I was like, yeah, I guess I kind of listened to that, to like Rachmaninoff, but really, I mean, like did I put that in there to balance out my love of punk rock too or something?
Yeah.
And like, you just sort of claim like, when you can make those choices and you can just sort of claim something, it actually does sort of change you. Like maybe sometimes it's aspirational. It's like my dad used to always tell me, like people would always be like, well, you're never going to read all those books. You have 3,000 books. You're not going to read them all. And he was always like, that's okay. The quality of a library says a lot about the kind of person you want to be. And I think there's something true to that. There's something aspirational about it, about sort of claiming something like that. But at the same time, you can make much more of yourself and think much more highly of yourself in the areas that you want to think highly of yourself than you properly should. And it happens. Maybe you don't really mean anything by it. But then all of a sudden it is insidious in the way that it begins to change the way you think about yourself. So you're searching for an identity and then you sort of claim it, but then you're not actually, you don't really have that identity. Like it's not really true of yourself.
Yeah. And we're always hyper aware that we're expressing, like that's often the primary thing that we're thinking about,
What am I making myself look like?
Right. And to some extent that's important. And there's a good quality of that too. Like we need to be thinking about being of good repute, right? Yeah. So how am I presenting myself? Am I presenting myself as somebody who's honest and trustworthy? But that's not the kind of thing we're typically doing, right? So typically when we're thinking about our expression, we're thinking about how am I building myself up? How am I increasing my brand? How am those sorts of things. Yeah. And I talked to my students a lot about romance and how I'm glad I didn't, you know, fall in love in a social media era, because sort of all the questions that you can just discover. Like, so if I saw a girl, you know, in a homeschool group when I was getting homeschooled, I would know nothing about her, right? And so I'd go home and ask my mom, oh, well, who's that new family, right? And what's that girl's name? And then I would ask my friends, and then I would like find little bits, and every piece of information was like discovering something interesting about this new person who's a mystery. And now
it necessarily had to be a little awkward, which is good.
Yeah, that's right. And mostly I would have to go to the person and ask them, oh, what kind of music do you like? And like discover that. But now I could, if somebody sees someone they're interested in, they can just, you know, discover them, get their name, find them on Facebook or on Instagram, see thousands of photos of them, videos of them, see tons of interactions, see basically, I mean, a lot of
info. It's pretty weird.
It is very weird. It's very weird.
But we really think about it. And of course, we don't probably need to sit on this show and like talk about the dangers of social media. I think probably almost everybody who's listening is like, yeah, we agree. We get it, guys. We're concerned too. So your book is due out tomorrow. We're actually recording on Friday, July 13th, but it's going to air on the 16th and it comes out on the 17th. Now I'm curious what your next book's going to be about. Is it a follow-up to this book?
It's going to be a similar style.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a boilerplate question. I apologize in advance. What are your sort of goals for this book? And I don't mean, obviously, I don't mean in terms of like the success of it, but what do you hope that someone who is reading Disruptive Witness is going to get out of it, or in what ways do you hope that they'll be able to, in what ways do you hope it'll be meaningful for people?
So my hopes are different. There are different levels. So I think, you know, the first half of the book is just diagnosing the problem. And I think for individuals, that's going to be a lot of the most helpful things. Because just being aware of what's going on to us and around us can help us make better decisions. And so that's what I think, that at the individual level, I think that's really important. And there are some, in the second half of the book, there's some actions that individuals can take. And I think that can be helpful too. But more broadly, I would love to see churches and then other institutions like schools, think through these ideas and wrestle with, okay, how can we create spaces that encourage contemplation? Do we, you know, ban cell phones? You know, what are we doing to signal to our, you know, our students, to encourage our students to live, to be contemplative and to wrestle with and acknowledge cognitive dissonance and deal with it as opposed to just sort of move on. Mm-hmm. And those big picture, that's what I would like to see. I have a section in there where I talk a lot about church liturgy. I think that churches have a major role to play. And so I would love to see the church sort of move away from adopting what, you know, Jamie Smith and others would call secular liturgies and basically formation during church service that doesn't stress the solemnity and awesomeness of God, the transcendence of God, and instead sort of entertains us and emphasizes eminence. So, those would be my sort of larger goals, hopes.
There's a lot of the Eastern churches still use some liturgy that's from like the first century, of course. And one, I think almost every Eastern church, I don't know about the Catholic churches, have a liturgical portion of the service that begins with the line, "Let us attend." Mm. And I love that idea that like church calls us
into
a contemplation, to paying attention to the things that are right to pay attention to. And it gives us the context, the environment to participate corporately in that contemplation, in that paying attention to the right things. And so that's, you know, ever since I recognized that line, heard that line, that's something that's been
important. That's a great one.
So, well, hey, thanks so much for joining me for this conversation. We've kind of went a little far afield, so to speak, but I know you've got kids that are, you know, are you distracting them with something?
They were listening to audiobooks. Okay. Their mother came home. My wife came home. So I don't know what they're doing now.
Okay. Well, I'll let you go, go help out. But again, thank you for joining me. I hope the book sells out. I hope it's a New York Times bestseller. I loved it. I hope everyone gets a copy of it. People can find it on Amazon, right? Amazon or IVP's website, or is there anywhere else that's beneficial for you for people to buy?
Those are good.
All right. Well, again, thanks for joining me, and congratulations on the publication of the book, and hope it all goes well.
Thank you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.